National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start with our new exhibition, Barocci, Brilliance and Grace, an exploration of a charming, yet today relatively unknown, master of 16th century Renaissance Italy. The show's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see major altarpieces by the artist, many from his native city of Urbino, which have never travelled before. But there's a feast of smaller works as well, including The Madonna of the Cat, in which the Holy Family, Joseph, the Virgin Mary, Christ Child and infant St John the Baptist, all gather by the hearth to play with the ginger and white cat. The show's co-curator, Carol Platzotta, told Leah Caribbean why the picture sets Barocci apart.
It is such a tender and intimate picture. The family really are having a lovely time. In fact, in the 19th century, people thought this was highly inappropriate for the Holy Family. And they thought that people should just be sitting looking very stiff and sober and proper. Well, this is not like Barocci's picture at all. And Joseph is leaning over, really having a good laugh at what's going on. The cat's up on its haunches, and Mary too is joyful, kind of surrounded by her family. And in fact, the palace that it was painted for was a small palace. It was a very intimate domestic space. And I've discovered that the picture was almost certainly painted for the Contessa's bedroom. So again, a lovely intimate space, which we know was also filled with other family portraits.
And the idea of brilliance and grace, there is definitely this gracefulness, but there is this extraordinary attitude, if you like, to colour. I mean, Barocci, to me, doesn't seem to be like any other painter at the time. There are these sort of, well, lemon yellows and sage greens and odd colours that you're not expecting.
Absolutely. I mean, Barocci was the probably ultimate colourist of the 16th century, and he worked alone outside the mainstream in a provincial Urbino. And so he developed his own sense of colour harmony. He didn't really go along with what else was going on in the 16th century. And he saw it in terms of musical harmony. In fact, he actually said, when the Duke one day visited him and asked him what he was doing, he said, "Well, I'm composing a tune."
Is it a case then that because he was really very individual and was working in Urbino, which although not a backwater, wasn't maybe the main event in Italy at the time, is that why we don't know about him very much today?
You can't say that that's the only reason, because of course Raphael was from Urbino as well. Raphael, who was born there about 30 years earlier, or 40 years earlier. But he is completely the opposite of Barocci. They couldn't be two more different personalities. Raphael was immensely ambitious, and he left Urbino for Rome, never to return. Barocci was completely the opposite. He lived in a much poorer house around the corner from where Raphael lived. He was very shy, very retiring, and when he did go to Rome, he actually was got terribly ill. We don't quite know why, but legend has it that his salad was poisoned at a picnic by jealous rivals, and he went back to Urbino and never left Urbino again. He wanted to live and work in the quiet of his own surroundings. And what's lovely about his work is that he populates these wonderful sacred images with the landscapes of Urbino, the animals around, especially the cats and the donkeys. The cats, he was a great cat lover. And finally, also the people. And his biographer tells us that when he used to go around town with a sketch pad and would often sketch people that he saw on the street and invite them back home if he found them particularly interesting, so that he could actually infuse his pictures with real humanity.
No, I have to say, I really like the sound of Barocci. Do you feel you've got to know him over the course of preparing for this exhibition?
Yes, absolutely. He's terribly intimate, cheerful, uplifting, and with a marvellous soul, a very spiritual man, who I think really loved life, loved nature. He sort of brings a religious work down to earth and makes it so accessible to the everyday viewer and people did love him at the time. His works became instantly popular, and he was very famous, more famous than he could probably cope with.
Well, time for him to become famous and well-loved again,
absolutely.
I think. Thank you.
Thanks to Carol Platzotter. If you want to get to know Barocci better, come along to the exhibition. It's just opened and will run until May. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. In last month's episode, we took a look at the stunning oil sketches of the 19th century American artist Frederick Church, currently on display in Room 1. The paintings are on loan from collections around the world, including the Terra Foundation for American Art. Catherine Bourguignon, one of the Terra's curators, came along to the gallery to see their paintings installed for the show and spoke to Cathy Fitzgerald about an exhibition highlight, a tiny but vibrant picture by Church called Our Banner in the Sky.
This painting by Church shows us a landscape, a natural landscape with a red sky. It's dawn. There's a sort of bare tree in the foreground, some hints of trees and mountains in the background. But as we look at it more carefully, we see he's used the white clouds and patches of blue and even some stars to actually depict the American flag.
Yeah, it sort of comes out of nowhere, doesn't it? You think to begin with you're looking at a landscape, and then out of this very luminous sky, a symbol turns up.
It's true. Once you recognize this, it's hard not to see the flag, and it becomes almost too obvious. But I do find it exciting to see visitors' first glance when maybe they haven't yet recognized it as the American flag.
And this flag of ours has a slightly tattered, woebegone look. Why is that?
Frederick Church was a northern artist, and this painting was produced in the spring of 1861, just a few weeks after the Confederate South had attacked Fort Sumter. And so during this attack, it was the American flag that was in question, because the Confederate South wanted their own flag. They were starting to secede. They wanted to be recognized as a separate nation. This is the beginning of the American Civil War, and what's interesting is that Church is truly trying to show a kind of natural, divine right to the North to fight this war.
Because it just emerges out of the landscape, it's part of what's around us.
He makes it seem as if it's just already there, and that if we look close enough, we will see it. So we have this bare tree that serves as a flagpole, and just above it, if you look carefully, is a form of an eagle, perhaps, again, a sort of symbol of the United States, just above the American flag, right at the very top of the picture.
And so he was painting this at a point when public fervor was high anyway. How was it received?
It was so popular that just a few months after Church finished it, a Goupil and Company in New York they were a company that made reproductions of paintings, and they paid Church for the rights to reproduce this small painting in a chromolithograph so that people could purchase it. And today, looking back, it was sort of rally around the flag, but this was for the North, who did not want to see these Southern states leave the nation. They fought the war in order to keep it as one country. They saw this flag as the most important symbol of that unity. And so the painting became a kind of symbol of that.
So how does this oil sketch fit with some of the others in the show? Because it is a little bit different, isn't it?
It's very different. You know, in the other works, especially in this exhibition, Church is not trying to be symbolic or poetic. He's painting the landscape, sometimes inventing, but usually just painting. These are the oil sketches, after all. And in this work, I think he shows us that he can read through the landscape, really look at it in a different way. And it's just so exciting to see these bright colors and this small work on the wall.
Catherine Bourguignon. Through American Eyes, Frederick Church and the Landscape Oil Sketch is currently on display in Room 1. Admission's free and the exhibition closes at the end of April. And don't forget the show's sister display in Room 46. It's called Through European Eyes, the Landscape Oil Sketch, and offers a chance to compare Church's work with the European tradition. There are many images of childhood in the gallery. One of the best-loved and also most enigmatic is a painting by the French 18th-century artist Jean-Siméon Chardin. The picture, probably dating to the mid-1730s, is called The Young Schoolmistress. Art historian Emma Barker gave us her take on the work.
The painting's called The Young Schoolmistress, but the point you have to realise is she's not really a schoolmistress. She's a little girl playing a game, teaching her brother to read from some very blurry characters. So whether these are even real letters, we can't be sure. She's looking down at him. She's holding a large knitting needle, and he is looking very intently down at the page and has his finger on it. So it looks very, very solemn and serious, but the whole thing is that it's a rather charming game.
It is really charming, but there are two things that I find really curious about the picture. The first is, I suppose, the size of the little, it is a boy, isn't it, a little boy's head in this rather large cap. I was wondering what that was about. And also, I was wondering why you think he is so strangely out of focus.
Well, he's dressed in the clothes that little boys wore until they were about 5 or 6 in this period. And little boys in particular, maybe I think little girls as well, wore these funny padded bonnets. And the whole point was to protect the fragile child's head against falls as the child was learning to walk. And I think this was obviously particularly important for boys, because there's this fear that boys are much more likely to run around and fall over and hurt themselves. But you have to understand that the way children are dressed in this period is part of a whole way of, a very traditional way of thinking about childhood as physically incredibly vulnerable. As soon as children were born, they would be wrapped up in swaddling clothes. And this was because it was thought that children were formless and needed to be shaped and disciplined into proper human beings, because the way they were born, they were almost like little animals. And it seems to me that the rather blurry way his face is painted is perhaps can be related to this whole attitude towards the young child's body as something that's rather formless. And certainly by comparison with his older sister, who has this very precise, neat profile and silhouette, and she's clearly wearing a corset. And children of both sexes, well-off children of both sexes, would wear corsets or bodices at this time. So there's the contrast between the older child, whose body is shaped and disciplined, and the younger child, who still remains somewhat formless, a kind of blur.
She definitely seems to have not only shape because of her corsets, but also poise. And there's something, obviously, due to her stays, something very straight about her back. But there's a sort of correspondence almost with the little pin that she's holding. What about her character? There's something slightly prim about her.
There's something very precise and neat about her. You know, she's like, what's the phrase, sort of as sharp as a new pin. This knitting needle, or whatever it is, I think, something that can be related to, you know, feminine adornment, this sense that what little girls are brought up to do is to sew and to knit, to adorn themselves. This sense, I think, that she's already a little woman in the making.
And yet there's something about the way that Chardin observes these children and something in the way that he paints them that seems to actually say something quite profound about childhood.
Oh, I think it is a very affectionate view of childhood, very sympathetic in many ways. I think there is a great charm in this seriousness and gravity with which they're both engaged in this game. I think it offers very much a parent's eye view of these children. And this is the tantalising thing about the painting. We're really up close to them, but at the same time, they're very separate from us. The little boy because of the blurriness of his face, and the girl because of the way she's seen in profile and turned away from us, so that we can't really see exactly what their game is. So that there is this sense that even though they are well-behaved children who are no doubt very docile to their parents' bidding, they nonetheless remain ultimately elusive and tantalising. And that, I think, is a lot of what makes this painting such a continually fascinating one.
Emma Barker talking about Chardin's The Young Schoolmistress, on display in Room 33. That's it for this month. If you're visiting, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily until 9 on Fridays. Until next time, goodbye.